Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Well, thanks again for coming and welcome to the second half. The story so far... Roxy Music have had some success and are about to embark on the sunlit uplands of the early 70s. And can we just show our appreciation once again for the great Phil Manzanera? So, Phil, we're now looking at a picture of Roxy Music around the time of the early success, and it seemed to be very rapid. How has life changed? It must have been changed very dramatically by that. Suddenly being in the charts and suddenly selling a lot of records.
We described ourselves initially as inspired amateurs, right, because we hadn't done hundreds and hundreds of gigs. And so there was a little bit of resentment from other musicians that we hadn't paid our dues. So we then embarked in that first year. In fact, I counted it up the other day. We actually did 100 gigs, which for Roxy is a lot. I probably not. but all over, I looked at the dates from when I first played at the Hand and Flowers pub in Hammersmith to New Year's Eve in Chicago, in America, in that year, 1972. I added it up. It's like 110 gigs or something. So we were determined to get better and to actually become more professional, I suppose. You know, there's a thing about your stagecraft, you know, learning how to actually put across the music. Technically, you know, things were dodgy. You know, you didn't have your own PA most of the time. You didn't have the incredible equipment that you can have now.
There's a fascinating section where you go fairly early on to America, and there's a lot of anticipation about Roxy Music. People read about them in the British press, and you support, I think it's Jethro Tull. Yeah. And it very hard to win the audience over, wasn't it?
Well, you know, in fact, the very first gig in America, maybe it was just the second one, but it was at Madison Square Garden supporting Jethro Tull. And, you know, if you've been playing at the Friars in Aylesbury and then you suddenly find yourself on stage at Madison Square Gardens in this enormous cavernous room and you've still got the equivalent of this kind of amp, and you don't know what's happening. And apparently, I've read subsequently that, you know, the first six rows were just full of journos who'd come to see Roxy, not to see Jethro Tull. And consequently, when we came off stage, they all left. There was this big gap in the front. But it was like some bad dream because, you know, we're in this huge cavernous place and we weren't used to playing those big venues. And, of course, they came on and they were fabulous. You know, the lighting was incredible. This PA suddenly was brilliant. And so we realised we had a lot to learn, you know.
Did you think of yourselves as a democracy in the early days? Yeah, I think there was no clear leader of the group, was there? I mean, that evolved a bit later. But in the original lineup, there was, you know, everybody had some kind of presence at the front of the stage, as it were.
Well, you know, at the very beginning, there was this sort of strange situation where you had Brian Ferry over to the right playing piano and sort of facing the curtain, basically, and not facing the audience. And then Eno to the left. And that left me and Andy in the middle, sort of instrumentalists, thinking, well, what do we do? So, you know, we did sort of crazy antics and things. But the management soon said, look, there's never been a band who doesn't have a lead singer in the middle to project and to be successful. So, you know, then Brian was persuaded eventually, you know, to come into the middle, Brian Ferry. And then we eventually got a keyboard player and stuff like that. So that was all part of the learning process. But, you know, one of the important, you know, when I'm trying to make sense of what that was all about and what Roxy was all about, I don't even know if I put it in the book, but now I'm, you know, what I thought, you know, I bought into the whole idea of the Beatles being, you know, like four brothers, or four musketeers, and they all appeared to live in the same house.
Yes.
You know, if you saw...
They,
you
know, did. They did.
The film Help, you know, and...
Tell me they didn't.
They did.
Sorry, Santa Claus, you know, doesn't... Oh, no. So, you know, I always wanted to be in a band that I thought was like the four, five, six musketeers, and All for One and One for All. What I realise now that Roxy was never that. It was more like an art collective. You know, I didn't realise at the time. And really, almost immediately, everyone started doing other things as well as Roxy. So Brian, straight off the bat, started doing solo albums of covers. And then Eno left, and I was working with him on something different. Then Andy did a solo album. And then eventually, you know, I put my hand up and said, can I do a solo album? And they said, oh, yeah, okay. You know, so we all... But that really set the pattern of everybody. I mean, if you had... When I think about it now, you know, if you had a bunch of painters and things, they wouldn't all get together and all... do a painting together, you know, say, well, I want black here, and then, no, it's pink, or whatever. You know, and it's the same with writers. And so the whole idea of bands, which started really at the beginning of the 60s, and we all got swept up. You know, most of the people who now do interviews, older rock and roll musicians, say that it was the Beatles and the Stones and then the Kinks and all that, who... And you bought into this idea of being like the sort of musketeers. But in reality, what happens is that all the normal things that happen with relationships come into play. And people want their ideas to be put forward first, or they don't want to share. Or, you know, and I found that weird. Sort of thing. You know, I'd been very much a person who was brought up on sort of hippie traditions of like sharing everything and all that. And I was thrust into a sort of more cutthroat world of pop music, and also not helped by a management company who would see the best way forward is to divide and rule. You know, so that... ultimately led to great periods of us not working together, you know, and pursuing our own solo projects. But miraculously, we seem to sort of get back together again.
Well, here...
The
interesting thing is that, you know, that we're talking about that business of being a group. The group were not on the cover of the records, and the records were very strong visual images, but not featuring the group generally. Did that cause any resentment?
No, not really. I mean, I was very comfortable with leaving the art direction to the professionals, really, which was, you know, people who'd studied art and image and generally knew the best photographers. And there was a team of people. So we're talking about Brian Ferry, led by Brian, Nick DeVille, who, you know, became a professor at Goldsmiths and taught the YBAs and things like that. Anthony Price and a top model from the day, and a amazing photographer, you know, who were the new generation of people coming up to sort of be the new leaders in all those areas.
Would you only get to know about it when somebody said, there's the cover of the next?
Genuinely, yeah.
What did you think when you saw Country Life?
Worried your mother was
going to... I thought, Christ, what's my mother going to say? So I went to this little muse house that the manager, David Entenhoven, had near the Kensington or somewhere. And the cover came out. I said, well, this is the cover. And the first thing that bobbed in my head, you know, my mum, what's my mum going to say? You know, Catholic little lady from Barranquilla. And it did cause a sensation everywhere. And, you know, there's so many different versions of that cover, yes, in a paper bag without, yeah, the girls.
Some
on
countries
the front
wouldn't have different versions, didn't they?
That's right. But, you know, I thought it was a very witty play on the actual Country Life magazine thing. But, you know, it had all sorts of overtones. But, you know, it was... I think what happened, Brian went on a holiday somewhere in Portugal and Anthony Price was there as well. And next door were staying these two ladies. And one was the girlfriend of the guitarist in Cannes and the other was the wife, the sister or something. And who knows what happened, but this is what happened. The picture evolved. So, yeah, I mean, in general, you know, I trusted them with that. You know, you can't do everything. And I had no, you know, I knew what I liked. And, you know, I had my own people who did my solo album artwork and stuff like that. And we had... you know, Diamond Head, and we had a famous guy, Philip Castle, do Listen Now, and then a famous photographer, Tony McGee, did K-Scope. So, you know, I had my own different kind of thing.
Right. So Roxy Music kind of, people go off into solo projects in the 70s, but then come back together again.
Yes.
In the late 70s. Was that ever in question as to whether they would or not? You would?
There's no plan. One of the things I always say about Roxy is that we should have been more famous or richer or whatever. The hopeless bunch of business people, just at the point when we were going to be absolutely staggeringly huge, we imploded and did something stupid. You know, so... if you map out the history of Roxy, right from 72 till last year, it's a succession of bungling, sort of inept businessmen, you know, who should have been a lot smarter, but basically just wanted to make music, get on with their own thing, but en route we produced some great tunes, you know. So overall, you know, when I'm trying to make sense of it, I'm very happy and very proud of them all. Right. And they're all still doing stuff today, you know. And we're all still in different combinations working together still.
I like the section very much when you got back together again in 2001. And firstly, you're offered a large amount of money, weren't you? Suddenly, I can't remember what it was, £7 million for 70 gigs or something, which was a lot of money at the time. But the other was that Brian just spontaneously announces that he's found a load of dancers, was it, that he wants to bring on the tour?
What, just yeah, 16 dancers or something? So what happened?
The night before, that's right. He sort of rang and said, oh, I've been to Quaglino's. And there's amazing dancers Quaglino. There. And, you know, we go... So, yeah, the first gig up in Glasgow has 16 dancers. I think by the time we got to London, there were four. But...
That's exactly what you want Brian Ferry to be doing, don't you think? Yeah. Going to Quaglino's, yeah. Just saying to 16 girls, come on our tour.
Yeah, it's terrific. Absolutely. Of course, it didn't faze me at all. Remember, I'd been brought up at the Tropicana Club in Havana with those kind of dancers. So I thought, bring them on. Yeah, bring it on.
So when you get to this kind of stage, you know, looking at a picture of you being invested into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or whatever it is...
Yeah.
This is now a pattern, isn't it, for all kinds of groups, that there's an early period of stellar success and nobody gets as much money as they think they ought to get, whatever, and then you reunite later on. Is there a conversation there where you go, now, this time, we're not going to do it the same way? The shares are going to be this?
I wish I could say there was a conversation. But it's pretty much hopeless sort of situation still, yeah.
Well, so bands don't talk, do they? Is that? It always seems to me to be the case.
Yeah, well, guys don't talk, do they? I mean, in general. I mean, I suspect that most of the members of Roxy, when they read this book, will be amazed. They had no idea of my background, really. You know, even though you spend so much time together, you're talking about music or the gigs or traveling, and then you go home and you want to see each other for ages. And you see
your background, you mean your family or the places you lived? Or,
yeah.
So they really didn't know about...
Well, maybe just superficially. I said, I lived in, you know, a few countries in South America. And I didn't go into detail about it because probably they weren't interested.
That is very male, isn't it?
It's really
interesting.
So there'll be journalists who know more about Roxy Music than the members of Roxy Music know about Roxy Music.
Yeah, I mean, I when I said to Brian that, you know, before Christmas, so I've got this memoir coming out. Don't worry, I'm not settling any scores or anything like this. But quite frankly, you know, you should write a memoir because I'd love to know what you were thinking.
Because I was only with you.
Yeah, at the time. And the same with Andy. You know, I'd love to know their perspective on the thing. It would be, you know, genuinely fascinating for me. But, you know, let's hope. You know.
So, that's Roxy Music. But at the same time, as you've referred to throughout, you talk about this in the book, you know, the value of and the joy of just working with a wide range of musicians.
Yeah.
Give us an idea. People think associate you with Roxy Music. I'm sure the people in this room know there's a lot more to you than that. But what's the kind of things that you'd like people to know more about of the range of what you do or have done?
Well, the fact that I speak Spanish, grew up with a Latin sort of background, means that I could actually understand what Spanish rock bands and Spanish musicians were singing about. So by default, I became the sort of number one producer in the 90s of rock, what they call rock en español. Now, nobody's probably heard of the Spanish bands, but for instance, there's a band called Héroes del Silencio. They're huge. They only did like 3 or 4 albums, but the singer is still going strong. He was 20 in 1990 when I first did the album. He'll be playing in a few weeks' time at Madison Square Gardens. He played Mexico City to 80,000 people. He's just played all over South America to 60, 70,000 people. He's like the David Bowie of Spain. He's incredible. Musician, no one's ever heard of him. I bet, hands up, anyone who's heard of Enrique Bunbury. No.
One hand has gone up.
Well, obviously
for the record.
Hello, Enrique.
Claire, you and
welcome.
My wife. Oh, and Lucas.
Him, actually.
Oh, all right. And Fito Páez, for instance, Argentinian, one of the most legends. They're all Grammy winners, not just Latin Grammy, Grammy winners in America. They're huge, absolutely huge. I produced one of his classic albums. I produced two of Héroes del Silencio albums. I produced this guy called Draco Rosa from Puerto Rico, who is like, his music is like Jane's Addiction, but the voice on top and the dancing is absolutely incredible. Very, very famous in South America, Mexico, and America, because there's a lot of Spanish-speaking people in America. So most people don't know anything about that side. But the reason I wanted to be a musician was, I guess, this is the sort of thing that you learn from writing this kind of stuff, is that I wanted to be sociable. I wanted to meet with other people. To a certain extent, I was like a single child being taken around the world. My brother and sister were at school in England. I felt, when I came to England, to South London, and I was in a boarding school, there was like a whole bunch of like people who say same age, having a laugh and stuff like that. So being in a band a bit was an extension of that. And then, but I wanted to be free. I wanted to be free to pursue musical conversations with all sorts of different people. So consequently, obviously, I gravitated towards Spanish-speaking people and amazing musicians from Cuba, Mexico, Argentina, Colombia, Brazil, etc. But also people from Japan, from South Africa. And music brings people together in a wonderful way. And that really has been a great extra part of my musical career, really.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Right, so those are people you've consciously worked with. I wanted to talk about some people you've unconsciously worked with.
Kanye West and Jay-Z here.
Tell us that story, because it's a corker.
Okay, so I can't remember even what year it was. Was it 2005? Could it be? I've got a studio in West London, and I'm driving down Westbourne Grove with my son Charlie. I think he's here tonight. He can vouch for this. And the phone goes, mobile phone. I sort of pull over. I think I pulled over. honest guy. And it was this person from New York saying, oh, hi, it's blah, blah, blah from Rockefeller Records here. Just want to tell you that Jay-Z and Kanye West have sampled your guitar, and it's on a track, and the album's coming out next week. And so I said...
It's coming out next week?
It's coming out next
not
week.
Not kind of, do no, you mind, no, or would you give me permission? Or
it's coming out next week. So we can't send it to you because it's top secret. So we play it down the phone. So I put it on speakerphone, and I said to Charlie, record it on your phone. And then we'll take it back to the studio. We'll do some crazy remix, send it back to them, just say, ha, ha, you know, whatever, you know, typical sort of thing. But basically, it sort of like, you know, ended the call and thought, well, great, that's fine. And then I suddenly thought, well, hang on, can they do that? Because I wrote it, and also, you know, it's on a record of mine, and I wrote it, so... There's a publisher involved as well. So I rang back. I said, well, hang on a second. I rang Virgin. I said, can I speak to the business affairs and say, do you know about this? Are they allowed to do it? He said, yeah. No, we've been negotiating this for months. You'll be very pleased, Phil. I said, really? I said, yeah, because you're going to get a third of the track and of the royalties. And in fact, you're going to get more than Jay-Z and Kanye West because there's so many people involved in this, but you're getting a third. So I thought, oh, that's great. So then I rang up the publisher. I said, do you know anything about this? Oh, yeah, no, you really. Yeah, no, you'll be very pleased, you know. You're,
and I'm getting a quarter.
But no, to start with, on the phone to New York, I said to the guy, look, I think you made a mistake because people always get my name mixed up with the keyboard player in The Doors.
Oh!
He's called Ray Manzarek.
Absolutely. So, fair point.
You know, I've been touring in America and people say, oh, Ray Manzarek. No. It's a Phil Manzanera. Who? And so they said, no, it's you. But then they played it down the phone and I sort of recognized it. But it was sort of slowed down.
So and this is a track of one of your solo albums from 1979 or something?
I think it's 1975, it's 1976. It's called K-Scope, and that's the name of the album. And it's an instrumental, you know. Instrumentals, you know, to a certain extent, they're fillers to a certain extent on albums because you try and write a whole bunch of songs. And then he said, well, let's do some instrumentals. And I needed an instrumental, and it was the night before going into this studio. It actually was Chris Squire's studio in the basement of his house. And I was watching the telly, and I just went bling, blong, bleggy, blong.
You're watching the telly?
Yeah, I'm watching the telly, and I'm a whole lifetime
just
watching the
telly. Just a few seconds work, basically.
A few seconds work.
You make a point about the financial impact of this.
Yes, that'll do. So I go into the studio the next day, and there's incredible drummer Simon Phillips and Francis Monkman, who are from the 801 Live Band, and Bill McCormick and everything. And we play this instrumental, and then it gets recorded. No one ever hears it, obviously, because it's sold nothing, probably. And then I forget about it.
So and 30, 40 years go by.
40 years go by, and suddenly God says, take that, you know, for your troubles, out of nowhere, this happens. And it just snowballs because it comes out. And but first of all, let me say that the genius of this guy who sampled it, his name's 88 Keys, and he's a friend of Kanye West, and he specializes in sampling only vinyl records that are recorded on analog between 1975 and 1979.
I love this.
And he combs all the record stores in Brooklyn and places like that, and he samples bits and pieces from stuff. And Jay-Z and Kanye West are, as you do, hire 5-star hotel suites to record their albums in. And they're holed up at this one in Soho in New York, and he rings 88 Keys and says, have you got any beats for me? Because we've got one more track to do, and we need to do it. And 88 Keys said, no. And also, my wife's going to kill me because I'm late to get home, and the kids are going to go to bed or something. And so Kenya says, oh, please come round and just play. He said, look, I haven't got anything at all. He said, oh, please come round. He said, okay, I'll come round. He goes, goes to the hotel, and they said, okay, what do you got? So he plays, okay, I've got 10 things. He plays them 10 things. They hear my thing, they go, we want that one.
God.
How random, you know. I mean, he slowed it down to half the speed. It was brilliant. That guy's a genius. And so, and they write a whole song on that. It's finished in 2 days. They get a guy called The Dream to do some rapping on it and stuff, and put the album to bed, and it becomes the single. It wins a Grammy. It's in a Great Gatsby film. It's in another film. It's in ads for the Super Bowl. It, and all this, it's like, you know, with a slot machine, the things are going round and ching, and suddenly this is going, and I'm saying to Claire, you're not going to believe this. I just had an email saying it's being used for a thingy ad.
And in the book, you contrast your earnings from that with your earnings from Roxy Music. Tell us how that balances
up. Well, I think I do put in the book that, you know, on the first album, there's six people, you know, Eno, Graham Simpson, Randy Mackay, Brian Ferry, me, Paul Thompson, and we get 5%. Between
you.
The six of us. That was only rectified about 2 years ago.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's a whole other conversation about the record industry and the new paradigm of the whole business and how it affects young musicians and things. But, you know, that's another book, someone else to write, not me.
But didn't you say you made more from that than your entire life working in Roxy Music? From that one piece of music written
from
in
one tiny
10 seconds
bit of,
on a sofa.
And they go, I want that one. That's how...
It's an amazing story.
Well, that's what's great and terrible about the music business. Anything can happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so there's no job security. You know, you've got to be prepared to fail. But nice things can happen as well. You just got to...
Stick around long enough.
Have good karma.
We must ask you about this. Another fantastic moment in the book where you are asked to be the MD of the Guitar Legends concert. It was in Seville. I'm trying to remember where it was now.
Yeah,
Seville.
It was an event, a pre-event for Expo 91, and they decided Seville guitars. We'll call it the Night of the Guitars. Obviously, we'll have. Five nights on BBC Two and live in America, all live, and we will provide a budget, not me, they will provide a budget to hire the best musicians in every genre related to guitars, mainly. And for some reason, I end up as the musical director. You know, I do say in the thing that I feel a bit like Forrest Gump. I seem to turn up all over the place. You know, like last week, I was producer of a number one swing album with Rod Stewart and Jules Holland. How did that happen? I have no idea. Anyway, I digress.
So who were the guitarists that you had to marshal into shape?
Well, every famous guitarist who wasn't on tour, you know, from... Well, I'd have to look at the list. There's so many famous. Les Paul... Roger McGuinn, B.B. King, Bo Diddley, Robert Cray, Brian May, Steve Cropper.
Yeah, you name him.
You name them, they were there. And then I had to come up with a concept for every night. So it's easy to start with a blues night, a soul night, a folk night, a rock night. Okay, the night where anyone is left over would be my night. I'd be the musical director as well for my night. And, you know, they needed to have some big names. So they had big names. Joe Cocker, Bob Dylan.
Bob Dylan. So this is the most fascinating bit of this chapter. Tell us about managing, trying to persuade Bob Dylan to do something that he probably doesn't want to do.
So they said, okay... Yeah, we were paying him a fortune. I said, right, you've got Bob Dylan, you've got all these people. You're going to have to rehearse Bob Dylan. And we want him to play what? We want him to play All Along the Watchtower, but not his version.
Oh, easy.
That'll be extra.
We want him to play the Jimi Hendrix version. So it's 80 degrees outside. This rehearsal room is underneath the stage, outdoor stage in Seville. Beautiful place, built specially for this. Marble everywhere. And we have a rehearsal room. I have the most incredible band of music, the Miami Horns. I have Jack Bruce on bass. I have the Billy Nichols and Cleveland Watlers, people who sing with The Who even now. Backing vocals, I've got Simon Phillips on drum, Pino Palladino on bass. On that one. Jack on that one. So we wait. You know, I go to I go to HMV. I said, right, I'm going to get all his records. Obviously, I know them, but I'm
going to get... There's quite a lot of them.
There's a lot of... Well, this is 1991. There's still a lot of records, so that I'm covered. Anything he wants to play, we've got it, you know. So I'm thinking, you know, but he's got to play this other number. So he comes in, and with his manager, who's still his manager now, he was very young then, and he's wearing a parka. And because it is chilly underneath, because it's air conditioned, so fine, he's looking after his voice, but he's got a green parka and stuff. And he says, Phil, this is Bob. And I'm thinking, yeah, I know who this is. You know, you don't... Bob, this is Phil. Okay, so, right, what are we going to play? So I'm sitting there thinking... So he suddenly says, do you know this Tex-Mex song from 1947? I said, well, we got all your stuff and, you know, we can play any of your tunes. You know? But this Tex-Mex song from 1947. So I said, no, but you... I'll tell you what. You play it and we'll learn it. From it. Now, on reflection, I'm thinking now... Maybe he thought I was Mexican. So maybe he was being nice.
Maybe he's Spanish-speaking.
You know? Yeah, Spanish-speaking. Manzanera. A tall, Brit-looking guy, but, you know. So I look at him, and he plays it. I say, okay, right. I say, should you play it again? He plays it differently.
That's Bob.
And then he plays it differently again. And then they're all... The music, Jack Bruce, is going, you know... I've got to go and do something. The drummer says, oh, I've got to phone my wife. And they all leave, and I'm just left with him. And he's looking at me, and he says, you know, Phil, why don't we just play acoustics? Just two of it, you know. I'm thinking, oh, Christ, what? You know, I said, but the thing is, Bob, that we've got to... The bubble in my head is saying, oh, you can't say this. It's Bob Dylan. He's right in front. We're going to play All Along the Watchtower, but it's not your version. I'm thinking, there's only three chords in All Along the Watchtower, let me just say. So they all come back in, and we crank it all up, we start playing, and he's by the microphone, and we go, we do the intro. I'm playing the Hendrix part, I wish. You know, I'm playing the Hendrix part, and he doesn't sing. He comes up to the microphone, and we're all going... This goes on. It's only three chords. It goes on and on. I said, right, okay, let's just stop. At which point, it's a big room, and there's, like, different setups in the room. At which point, Keith Richards comes in.
Oh, God. Just
to add to your problems.
Oil of troubled waters.
And it's his turn for rehearsals. Oh. So it's like, oh, your rehearsal time's over, mate. And so they go over and start... kicking the hell out of their thing and playing rock and roll. And the drummer stands up and points at Dylan and says, you, come and sing. And he goes over and starts singing. You know, I think, oh, very British of me, yeah. Yeah. Just too polite, you know. So I go off and scratching my head. And I think, I know that I'm cunning, you know. I think, I know he likes Richard Thompson. So I ring Richard Thompson... who's playing in Amsterdam. I say, Richard, would you like to play with Bob Dylan? You know, hey, who wouldn't, you know? He said, yeah, great, okay, we'll send you flights and everything, just come. So he arrives, and then I say to him, having a bit of a problem sort of working out what the hell he's going to play. So I said, you go into his dressing room. We're now getting very close to the gig, like the night before and stuff. And it's live. And the manager has said to me, Bob might come on, he might not. If he doesn't come on, who's going to sing? Jack Bruce just explodes. His head explodes at that point, you know, with the Glaswegian expletives. And you don't want to get on the wrong side of Jack. Rest in peace. Lovely guy. So Richard goes in, and I only found out like a couple of years ago when Richard came to my studio. I said, what did he say when you went in? And he said, do you know this Tex-Mex song from 1946?
Yes, very fantastic.
And Richard said no. I said, you play it to me, play it different every time. So if you can watch on YouTube, if you we're all like looking, is he gonna come on? He said, but if he does come on, make sure you announce him. And obviously I said, Signore, Signores, El Señor Bob Dylan, because I could see his spotty shirt in the background. He comes out and you can see us all thinking, what's he playing?
Yeah.
You know, we're all, you know, you could see people going, C,
G,
you know. And apparently it was Boots of Spanish Leather, but it was, you know how he does different versions?
Of the Tex-Mex version.
Yeah, you can, you're Mexican, yeah, 1947 version.
Fantastic. Very good.
But everybody has a Bob Dylan story. And I spoke, Phil Ramone was the producer on that. And I asked him, how do you, he produced also a Dylan album. I said, how do you record Bob? He said, you just stand there. He comes in and he does whatever he wants and then he leaves and you just...
Absolutely.
Gather whatever you can.
Pick up the pieces.
But the guy's, you know, fair enough, he's Bob Dylan.
He's Bob Dylan,
he's Bob Dylan. He can do what he likes. He's fantastic.
So we're looking now at a picture of you as a member of a kind of all-star group with Robert Wyatt and David Bowie who've we got? Dave Gilmour and David Crosby and so forth. I mean, do you ever reflect when you... I mean, this is some while ago, but do you ever reflect that you're very privileged to have this kind of third age of, you know, a profession that you entered when you were 20, 21 or whatever, and you're still in it, and you're still working with some of the same people after all these years?
I'm the luckiest guy. You know, it's what I wanted to do. You know, I used to say that when I joined Roxy, it was like Christmas every day. And it was, you know, it was just so exciting. It's what I always wanted to do. And just, you know, found that if I just sort of stay in my lane and keep going and just try and be a good person, things will happen. And so I've ended up with these things sort of happening. Incredibly lucky. I seem to be lucky. And, I mean, that was the only time I ever played on stage beside David Bowie, and it's his last ever performance in the UK when he came on and sang Arnold Lane and Comfortably Numb at the Albert Hall with David Gilmour and all those other... I haven't mentioned it before, but to have Robert Wyatt and David Gilmour there, two people who I met when I was 16.
Yeah. Yes, they both helped you, didn't they, get started? And
I mean, David was a friend of my brother's, and when my mother was the nice Colombian lady who understood cumbia, didn't really understand rock and roll, and I said, I want to be a rock and roll musician. What's that? You know, and my brother said, let's go and meet this guy I know who's just become a professional musician. Ask him what you have to do to become a professional musician. And we had lunch, and it turned out to be David Gilmour, and he'd just joined Pink Floyd. You know, that was in 1967, in January 1967.
What was his advice? Can you remember?
Well, he can't remember, but he said he must be bloody good, because 5 years later, you joined Roxy, and I think I should get a percentage.
Why do you think? Final question, really. Mm. Why do you think you get the call to do these things? Do you ever reflect on what it is that your peers value about you? I'm not asking you to be flatter yourself or anything like that, but you must have some kind of view.
I don't know, but Robert Wyatt's wife, Lady Alfreda Brenge, used to say a few years ago, "You seem to be like a facilitator." And I've thought about that. I thought maybe that's what it is. I know a lot about music, and I think I mentioned before, one of the great bits of advice that Ian McDonald gave me was to think conceptually and think about context. Why are you doing what you're doing? What are we doing here? And that's the kind of question. And also, you know, when it comes to production and working with people, I think of George Martin. You know, I'd never touch the desk or anything. I think about the big picture, really.
Right, okay. That's a good answer. Excellent answer.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.